Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:56 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is April 28th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought I'd kick off with the Bank of Japan's balance sheet. You can see that it really hasn't gone anywhere for nearly 2 years, and that's on the back of them coming out today and basically saying that they're not going to abandon their quantitative easing policy, and that their efforts to ensure that the bond yield doesn't exceed 50 basis points are probably going to persist as well. And this is a graphic representation of the toll that's taking on the yen. So, because the yen has been depreciating, then the size of the Bank of Japan's balance sheet has actually been going down. Now, it did rise towards the end of 2022, but now it's encountering resistance in the region of that 1,000-day or 5-year moving average. So now the big question is, what next for monetary accommodation in Japan? Well, at least if they are going to persist with ensuring that the bond yield does not exceed 50 basis points, then yields are going to be contained, and that was a good sized downward dynamic in here today. So it does suggest that they're willing to continue to defend that level. It does obviously raise some important questions. So, Japan is willing to tolerate inflation in the region of about 4% and still trending higher. And they are willing to do that because they don't believe that it's going to last. And their forecast that it was issued today suggests that inflation is probably going to come back down to around 2% over the course of the next couple of years, and it has contracted a little bit from 4 to about 3.2% over the course of the last 6 or 7 weeks. So against that background, this isn't the first time that they've had inflation up to 4%, and perhaps we should think about what happened back in 2013 and 14. That was also a time when they were depreciating the currency. And it was a time when there was a lot of hedged trading activity into the Nikkei. And there were lots of funds and ETFs with hedged exposure to Japan were created. The Nikkei was up nearly 400 points today. It is on the upper side of this range that's been forming for more than 2 years. I think it is particularly important to look at this over a very long time scale to put into perspective just how long it has been ranging for. And in US dollar terms, it got up to test those peaks from 1989 in 2021. And in local currency terms, we're well shy of that, but it does look increasingly likely that it will pop on the upside. Now, let's then just look at what the topics is looking like. And there we have a 2-year first step above the base. And that's an exceptionally lengthy base. And we had a very strong performance in the topics from 2012 through to 2014. And that was certainly welcoming Koizumi back. Or excuse me, not Koizumi, Abenomics. And then we've definitely seen a process of consolidation over the last few years, but this looks like it's popping on the upside. In nominal terms, it's certainly benefiting the exporters from Japan. So Japan being willing to devalue their currency is obviously going to be a topical subject in Europe because they compete for many of the same export markets. And the euro now is right in the region of its peak relative to the yen from back in 2014. And it does beg the question, what's Europe going to do about the strengthening currency? So nobody wants a strong currency, but some countries need a weaker currency more than others. So Japan right now is basically devaluing their currency. The yen is falling against the dollar, so dollar appreciating on this chart and bouncing from the 130 level and the region of the peaks from back in 2015. And it does look increasingly likely that we're going to see additional weakness in the yen. And I think it is worth highlighting that the more back history we go for, just how acute this process of devaluation could potentially get, that we have not seen the yen trading sustainably above our, well, the dollar trading sustainably above 150 relative to the yen in a very long time, all the way back to 1987. So this would be an incredibly lengthy base formation completion. But what it also suggests is that Japan is willing to depreciate their currency, that they're so intent on trying to create an inflationary bias that they're going to wait until it's absolutely incontrovertible. That means that at and one of the big questions I've asked, and I do think it is the perhaps the most relevant one, is could Japan have created an inflationary outcome when the entire global economy was going through a disinflationary period? So in order for them to create inflation, they're going to have to leave interest rates down for a prolonged period and allow the rest of the world to see to go through its own inflationary cycle to find out where do inflation measures eventually stabilize, and then do they move higher from there or not? And then what effect will that have on the domestic Japanese economy? Now, when they talk about that they are going through a period of reflection and that they haven't made any hard decisions, well, if their target is going to be that we're going to have a deflationary environment by 2026, that also begs the question, is Japan going to be the only place that has inflation coming back down by 2026? Well, 10-year yields in the USA are contracting, and they were down in here today by 8 basis points. Now, still not breaking down through the 200-day moving average, but there's certainly a downward bias to trading overall. And it does really beg the question, what's next for the economy? So I think that the only possible way that we can think about what's going on right now is as an inflationary boom. So when we think about, for example, the strong performance of Microsoft. So they've made a big investment in artificial intelligence. They are certainly very eager to say that they believe it's going to be the primary growth driver of the future. And then their cloud computing arm also did well in these earnings, and this was a very big week on the upside. So that's a clear break of the more than year-long downtrend, and we have a succession of higher reaction lows, and the 200-day moving average has turned upwards. It's a bullish chart overall. But then let's also pay attention to valuations. And on a price-to-sales ratio, it's at 11. It's traded. I don't think that a book value is going to mean a lot for a software company, but sales is certainly something that we should pay attention to. Now, obviously, it's a very cash-rich company, and then the big question is, how are they going to justify that high price to sales ratio? Well, of course, they have over 100 billion in cash, and their total debt is minuscule relative to their cash. So Microsoft is not a company that has been increasing its debt load overall. But let's just look at the performance of the share. And we've had a phenomenal bull market. Ever since it adopted a subscription business model, stopped selling software from 1 year to out to 3 years, instead taking a slice every month, then the share price has done nothing but rise. So this has been a really profound advance. And it begs the question, how is that going to be sustained? Is artificial intelligence overhyped, or is it something that really has legs? Well, I've talked to a lot of people about what they think of artificial intelligence and people messing around with it. And I find a lot of different, I've had a lot of different discussions. So the broad perspective is that people are impressed by the grammatical, or just how well it writes. And then there's all, an even-handedness to it, which makes it very clearly identifiable. But then there is huge room for inaccuracies. And then there has been a very clear effort by OpenAI in particular to censor the AI. And a very good example of that is if you ask it, if you ask ChatGPT to tell you a joke about the Bible, it will. If you ask it to tell you a joke about the Quran, it won't. So then it has obviously been censored. And there are certain things that it will not talk about and others that it will. Now, this is an ex this is a realistic problem because if there are areas of questioning that are beyond the pale, well, then it does beg the question, if the growth of the sector were to reach the scale of Google, then that kind of censorship is going to be built in, and that is something that could have electoral consequences. So when we think about the growth of AI, these are very important questions that will need to be addressed at some stage, but probably not immediately. And as long as Microsoft is holding the $250 area, then the benefit of the doubt can probably be given to the upside. But it's not going to continue higher indefinitely with a price to sales ratio of 11. So one thing that I think is especially interesting is that companies like Microsoft and Apple, two of the largest companies in the market, they have been able to sustain their moves above their respective trend means. And Apple didn't really pull back to nearly the same extent as other big companies. Now I'm going to put the 1,000-day moving average up there as well. There have been several occasions when Apple has come back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average and bounced, and it's done so again. So, on the one hand, we have the Bank of Japan predicting that inflationary pressures are going to fall back. And we know that 10-year yields are now contracting. Now that means that there's more demand for those bonds. And yet the earnings of the larger cap companies are implying that they will be completely unaffected by a weakening economy. And that's a bit of a contradiction. It does appear to be rather hopeful that that will be the case. So let's just think then about where we are in terms of the overall cycle, because the 10-year minus the 3-month is currently at negative 161 basis points and trending lower. So the yield curve spread continues to invert. Now, you have to go back to the early 1980s to see an inversion that's this deep. But one thing that is, I think, most particularly relevant is that the longer you have an inversion for, the more likely it is that it will contribute to a deflationary force. And that does imply that perhaps, well, at least maybe that is what the Bank of Japan is thinking about when they are predicting that deflation will take over by 2026. From a market perspective, it's generally at it or it's quite clear that perceptions of what markets will do go through a predictable transformation during an inverted yield curve. So at the very beginning, when the market becomes in, or when the yield curve becomes inverted, then people rejoice that central banks are finally doing something about an inflationary problem that's getting out of control. Now let's think about what that could have been back in 2006 and 7. Well, commodity prices were surging higher, and people were really worried that we were going to run out of oil and run out of food, and that there was going to be this really problematic inflation. And then, of course, central banks tightened and caused the credit crisis, and then there was a perennial fear of generational long deflationary forces. Well, in the aftermath of the pandemic splurge of spending, there was a jump in inflationary pressures, and central banks were commonly deemed to be behind the curve. They finally acted. The Federal Reserve has been particularly aggressive in raising rates, and certainly more so than other developed markets. And that was greeted by markets with relief. So stock markets have rebounded in a very firm manner. Then we get to a point where there are fears that perhaps the central bank has gone too far, and you start to see maybe growth beginning to ease back, pressure starting to evolve within the banking sector or the credit markets, but stocks are still firm. So that's the Goldilocks period, where credit conditions begin to tighten, but the impact on corporate earnings have not yet been felt. And that's where we are right now. But then you get to the third phase, and that is usually when central banks are cutting interest rates. Now, it is well understood that the Federal Reserve is quite likely to raise rates next week. And then investors are also pricing in the potential that they may have to raise rates again in June. But the 2-year yield peaked at 5%, and it steadied a bit yesterday, and it was a bit weaker in here today. But mostly what this looks like is a pause in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, this is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and it's a failed upside break. So this is a type 2 top formation. And following the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, then it's quite normal to see a period of right-hand extension or ranging. And what I've often considered that to be is a first step below the peak. But you get that ranging because first people are shocked by the massive move. Then they ask, has anything really changed? And surely interest rates are going to continue rising. And don't we still have inflationary pressures? And isn't there a new inflationary trend overall? That is one of the factors what is stopping yields from contracting further. But ultimately, if those yields don't move and we continue to see a weakening economic environment, then the chances of those rates actually going up more or staying higher for longer will be reduced. I remain very much of the view that interest rates are likely to come back and test the 1,000-day moving average. And that would be at least a 200 basis point cut for the rate, potentially even a 300 basis point cut, and take us down into that 2% handle. Now, I think it's very interesting that if we look at the foreign holdings of, and I think let's just look at the major foreign holders of the U.S. Treasuries. There was a very strong growth phase all the way from 2001 all the way up until the peak in 2021. And since then, we've had a meaningful contraction. But it hasn't broken the uptrend, but it is trending downwards. So there's a lot of talk right now about de-dollarization. And it does behoove us to start thinking about why is the Federal Reserve raising rates faster than anyone else? Why has it been so aggressive? And particularly when you look at the rather modest pace that the Bank of England or the ECB have engaged in. Well, it might be because they're really worried about inflation. They're more worried about inflation than those other central banks, and that they're willing to raise rates in order to get that inflationary problem under control. And that's, I think, first order thinking. I think second order thinking is that China, Japan, Saudi Arabia aren't buying as many bonds as they have in the past. In fact, China is actively trying to sell theirs, or is certainly allowing them to mature and not reinvesting. So that means that the USA needs to find new buyers for its bonds. Well, the easy way to do that is to raise interest rates and push yields higher in order to find willing buyers. And I think there's lots of people are willing to buy US paper at between 4.5 and 5%, because at the S&P 500 for the year is up 7%. So instead of taking risk in the stock market, then you can just buy bonds and you're making 5%. And that pickup from the stock market isn't really enough to encourage a lot of investors. Now, of course, if you want to go out the risk profile, you could go for the NASDAQ 100 or you could go elsewhere. But they're certainly creating an active market in buying treasuries when yields are this high. Now, if that is an important consideration, then it would limit the decline in yields. Now, I certainly think that there's clear potential that they could cut interest rates by 300 basis points. I just don't think that they're going to cut by 500 basis points. And the fact that the US government is still running deficits and doesn't really have a good idea about how to get that under control suggests to me that this is going to be an ongoing issue. So, obviously, that is one of the reasons why the dollar has been weak. That the plans for continued issuance of treasuries is certainly going to ensure there's plenty of supply. But if we are in a process of de-dollarization, then one of the most effective ways of combating that will be to ensure that there is a viable market in treasuries. But then, of course, they would need to stabilize the US dollar. And that is, I think, where the rubber really meets the road, because there are massive unfunded liabilities, and nobody wants to pay extra taxes, and nobody wants to take a hit to Social Security or to wages. And public sector unions remain as powerful as they have ever been. So that's obviously problematic. But de-dollarization also implies that other currencies will see more trade. Now, we've definitely seen that the renminbi has become a more international currency. And the renminbi today was a little weaker, or at least this week, a little bit firmer today, a little bit weaker during the week. So now the question, of course, is will China allow the renminbi to appreciate? And of course, it has its own domestic issues, and they are attempting to ensure that they don't reflate the property bubble. So China has basically said that they are not going to supply a lot of additional liquidity. So that's another central bank that is reducing the size of its balance sheet, not providing the kind of liquidity necessary to inflate asset prices around the world. And then if we look at that central bank balance sheet, the total assets of central banks, it peaked right at the beginning of 2022 and it continues to contract. Now, that's the biggest contraction we've seen. So if we have to think about, well, why are credit conditions around the world tightening up? Well, that's the reason. So then let's think about what happens with the renminbi. China stopped issuing data on the foreign transactions in its debt. So that probably means that investors are exiting Chinese government bonds, but the actual yield is contracting, suggesting that there's plenty of people in China are buying those bonds. Since China is not going to be providing additional stimulus, that is supportive of the outlook for their domestic bond market. So the bond yield there has broken down through the 200-day moving average, and this is a meaningful breakdown. But because they're not supplying a lot of additional new liquidity, then that is weighing on the stock market. So it's been ranging below the 1,000-day moving average. Now it was off the low in here today. Might yet push back above the 200-day moving average, but it at a minimum will have to break back above the 4250 level in order to confirm that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. Now, let's look at some of the leaders in the last cycle, like BYD, and it has rebounded from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The Chinese government are encouraging purchases of vehicles. So that is certainly beneficial for BYD, and they have released an electric hatchback that is quite modestly priced. So they're certainly going after the cheaper end of the market. And of course, Tesla is engaged in a global price war. One of the reasons for that is they're cutting prices in the US in particular so that people can qualify for the tax credits, and especially if they can also try and sell people the expensive self-driving software. And I'm holding up my hands and making the inverted commas sign when I say self-driving, since it has not yet been approved, and self-driving still sounds like a bit of an exaggeration. So, geopolitical tensions between the USA and China, and those are going to continue to rise. And China has a vested interest in ensuring that its currency and its bond markets are stable. And the USA has a vested interest in ensuring that its own government bond markets are at least stable and liquid. But then you have the big question about where are we going to see the pressure points? So ASML was well off its lows in here today, and it's bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. And this is another company with a price to sales ratio around, well, this time 9. So it's not like these are cheap companies. And when we think about Nvidia, it has a price to sales ratio of 25. So, when we think about how expensive some of these companies are and the fact that they are still rising, and this is coming back into bubbly activity. We had a meaningful contraction in valuations in 2022, and earnings haven't really been growing to justify this increase. So there's a lot of money sloshing around that is betting on artificial intelligence. And I'm going to tune into MIT's artificial intelligence conference on Sunday and Monday. And it's a bank holiday in the UK, so I'm going to take that day off. I'll just spend all my time at the MIT conference. And I want to learn more about artificial intelligence, but the thing that's really at the back of my mind is that if you put garbage in, you get garbage out in any model. And artificial intelligence works really well when you have 100% confidence in your, or I guess in the broad data set that you're using. As soon as you have subjective data, then the answers that come through from any kind of model aren't going to be reliable. And I don't know that artificial intelligence can get around that. Now, that doesn't mean that artificial intelligence can't be used to write music, for example, since so much of music is derivative anyway. And there is the possibility, and for example, Bloomberg has been using automation to write news releases for years. This isn't a new phenomenon. So I really am interested to figure out what is new, what is the breakthrough, rather than just simply releasing a natural language bot. Where is the creativity going to come from? Where are we going to see the big enhancements in productivity growth? Because in order to have a secular bull market, you need productivity growth. And that's the big question now. Is the promise of AI going to deliver that productivity growth? And certainly NVIDIA is rallying because regardless of whether the promise is true or not, there's going to have to be a lot of data centers built to tackle the traffic for all that computer-driven calculation. So that's why the share remains quite firm. How sustainable that is, I think, very much open to question. But as long as the trend is consistent, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But because we have an inverted yield curve, because we have banks that are continuing to go bust. So, for example, this week it was First Republic Bank, and the share was halted on several occasions today. And it's approaching zero. There's a very strong chance that today's the last day of trading and that it will be taken over by the FDIC over the weekend and probably merged into JP Morgan. Now, the broader banking sector has steadied in here. So the S&P 500 banks was off its lows this week and still hovering here below the psychological 300 level and the lower side of the overhead trading range. And it could potentially rally back up. Now, we've had a blanket guarantee on deposits, so deposit flight shouldn't be that much of an issue. The problem for a lot of banks is that with an inverted yield curve, they don't make money. So then, when you have an impaired balance sheet, an inability to make money, and a lot of assets that are trading way below the rates at which they were bought, then you're in a really problematic area. And that also means that the availability of credit will contract. Now, when we think about the high yield spread, it is holding in the 500 basis point level. Now, generally speaking, when spreads are around 500 basis points, that's usually when you start to see problems in the high yield market. And of course, these issues we're seeing in the banking sector, particularly the small regional banks, that's certainly something that is representative of that kind of stress. Several of the banks that have gone bust have also been in California, and PacWest looks like it's probably going to be the next one. After First Republic goes bust, then short sellers will move on to PacWest, and it looks like it's already starting to roll over. So we're not yet at the end of this crisis. We have inverted yield curves, we have tightening credit, we have money supply growth that is negative. So this is the first time ever that money supply growth has gone negative, and it continues to go negative. So it's down now to ni minus 4.1% on a year-over-year basis. Now, a lot of these issues can be rationalized. We can say, well, the size of the Fed's balance sheet went up so quickly, so they need to reduce it. The money supply growth was off the charts, so now some of that money has to be taken out of circulation. We can look at the stress in the banking sector and say, well, this is just a reflection of rising interest rates, and when rates come down, these problems will evaporate. And to a greater or lesser extent, that is true. But it also means that between now and then, banks are going to be under stress, and they're not going to be able to lend until interest rates come back down. Now, the valuations that are being attached to the largest cap companies, well, that's really based upon the assumption that there isn't going to be any impact to earnings. And I really think that that is just too much to believe in. Now, Amazon announced today that its cloud or its Amazon Web Services division was disappointing. So that contrasts really quite acutely with what Microsoft was saying, and it suggests that Amazon is losing market share. What we've also seen is that they're now starting to charge for returns. So that's going to sour the views of consumers on the outlook for whether they should be using Amazon or not. And I think this is still a reasonably consistent downtrend, and as long as it is trading below the 1,000-day moving average, I'd be willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. But what I'm most especially interested in is the underperformance of companies like Costco. And the share was in positive territory this week, but there's a clear sequence of lower rally highs. And as long as that remains the case, then we need to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. In an environment where we have the USA as the epicenter of risk, and the big question is, I think the and within the USA, the epicenter of risk is the commercial property sector, and then the companies that have lent the most money to the commercial property sector. So that's certainly important. Now, the dollar index was a little steadier in here today, but the most important thing is the more back history we look at, the greater the evidence is that there are 7-year trends on the downside, a bit of messing around, and then generally a 7-year trend on the upside. Now, this one is long in the tooth. So either the long-term cycle has been broken or the dollar is going to roll over. Now, in a recessionary environment where you get selling pressure, then the dollar generally rises. So that could lend some short-term support to the dollar. And I think that is the primary reason why gold has been pausing here around the $2,000 level. It did race to get here, and we're getting some consolidation. And as long as consolidation is all it is, then there's clear scope that it's going to break on the upside. If the dollar trends lower and we see that the USA prints money to offset a recessionary environment, and that you see some pressure coming off in terms of the inflationary pressures because deflation starts to run riot, there's the potential that what we're looking at instead might be stagflation, that inflation doesn't go down, or it doesn't go down enough, but unemployment rises. And then you have to print money to get over the unemployment issue, and then that exacerbates your inflation issue. So that's what gold has started to price in, that they're not going to quite be able to get in control of inflation, or that the economy is going to weaken before inflation really comes down enough. And we're starting to see what that might look like. So we're in an inflationary boom right now, and we're in the Goldilocks phase of the yield curve spread. But then the bigger question is, how much will interest rates go down? And then how much liquidity will they make available? The clear reason for being bullish on gold is because it's been going sideways for a prolonged period, and there's the potential that the volume of dollars is going to increase in response to slower economic growth. During 2008, the gold price collapsed during the credit crisis because the dollar surged. And in 2001, the stock market rolled over. There was a mild recession, but the dollar went down. So gold appreciated. So rather than thinking about gold contracting during a recession, I think it is more accurate to think about gold as an anti-dollar. And if the dollar contracts in response to a recession, then we're going to see a significant breakout in the precious metals sector. And then silver prices have rallied enough to break the medium-term downtrend. And I think considering the speed with which prices went up, it is quite normal to see some consolidation in this area. I've been pleasantly surprised at just how shallow this reaction has been. I think that there is still scope for some additional weakness, and I believe that that will be a buying opportunity. And I think that this entire range by silver is just one big first step above the base. And when it does break above 30, then the next point of potential resistance will be at the all-time peak from back in 2011. And I do think that it is very likely that by the time we get to the end of this big emerging bull market in precious metals, that the price of gold in on or at least adjusted for purchasing power parity will have exceeded the peak from back in 1980. And that's suggesting a really significant advance from where we are right now. But the times when the dollar is weaker, then that is generally very positive for emerging markets. Actually, before we look at, I mean, I guess here we have Mexico pushing up out of its most recent range, a little first step above the 7-year base formation, and driven higher by a stronger budget, excuse me, trade surplus. And then also the potential that Mexico will be one of the primary beneficiaries of geopolitical tensions and more like nearshoring or friend shoring activity by the corporate sector. We've also started to see that the welcome for China, for Western companies in China is not nearly as accommodative as it used to be. And Bain and Co. was raided in here today by the Chinese authorities. Now, if we look at the MSCI, and let me see if I can find my, and I'm afraid I cannot remember the ticker that I created, so I'm going to go find that. But what I'm looking for is the MSCI ex-US relative to the now here we are. So this is at the MSCI. My golly, I'm really struggling to find my own tickers. So might be down here for world. And that's really very, I do apologize. And let's see if we can do this. The CMSCI World and Gold. So maybe we should just look at that for the moment. And the price of gold has been appreciating relative to the MSCI World. It's also been in this very long range for the better part of a decade, and this just looks like a broad basing pattern overall. So there wasn't really a long period of time when gold outperformed the, or excuse me, when MSCI World outperformed gold. Now, when we think then about where we are in terms of this longer term cycle, so the ex-US part of the market is certainly something that is worth considering that we've had a long period of time when the US market was really the only place to go. And now we're in an environment where we've seen a significant rebound in US non-US assets. So I think this is a really meaningful change overall, that we haven't had a long period of outperformance by the ex-US portion of the market for more than a decade. But there was a good long period between 2001 and 2006 when we had this strong performance by non-US assets. And that was inextricably linked to the underperformance of the dollar during that time. Now, I created a chart for the EAFE relative to MSCI World, and we can see that we have that breakout coming through here. So a very long period of underperformance and subsequently a big move on the upside. We have then this very clear move relative of value versus growth. So I think growth has outperformed in a big way over the last month. I've highlighted just how high those valuations are at present. I don't believe that this is sustainable, particularly if we see that the Federal Reserve continues to raise rates. I just don't believe that a soft landing is likely, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to be right. But if a soft landing is achieved, then the dollar may not go down as much. So the value versus growth has broken down through the 200-day moving average. The performance of the ex-US markets relative to the US market hasn't quite broken down yet, and it is still pushing on the upside, in fact. So when we then think about, well, what are the potential outcomes? Well, what I find rather interesting is that we have Mexico that's pushing on the upside, and we have the Indonesian market that, on a currency-adjusted basis, is now right on the cusp of completing a very significant range. And then the Korean market has broken its downtrend, and that's being led higher by a recovery in Samsung, and it is bouncing this week from the region of the 200-day moving average. And now let's look at South Africa. So there is obviously a problem with electricity provision in the South African economy, and the bigger question then is, what's the likelihood that the rand will appreciate? When we redenominated into US dollars, we're still very much within a ranging environment. So I think these are important considerations, that the markets that are doing best are those that are likely to benefit from friendshoring. Indonesia, as both a high population market with a young population and then also a commodity exporter, is likely to be one of the bigger beneficiaries. Then the Vietnamese ETF has at least begun to steady here, and it does have a sequence of higher reaction lows, so this is potentially bottoming activity. And then let's just look at an India ETF to just get a currency-adjusted look at how it is performing. And it is now testing the region of the 200-day moving average. So the US markets have been outperforming by a considerable margin for a prolonged period of time. And The strength of the dollar over the last 8 years has been one of the most significant factors there. So not only did you have the strong dollar, but you had the complete outperformance of the technology sector. Well, today the dollar looks like it's rolling over, and the technology sector is exceptionally expensive. Whereas the potential for growth in the wider globe, but most particularly those kinds of countries that would benefit from the reorientation of global supply chains. Now, I hesitate to call that de-globalization because it's not like we're going to see lots of industries just go back to where they originated. That's just unlikely. But what's much more likely is that we'll have manufacturing that is going to be focused on China and servicing the Chinese population sited in China. And manufacturing focused on other geographical areas will be focused and sited in areas that are geographically more close to those places. And then, of course, you have places like Indonesia that are a lot closer to China and India, but then also has the large population and the potential to export just about anywhere. Now, let's also just bear in mind that the euro has been quite firm, and European stocks are finally starting to push on the upside, and we've had a meaningful rebound since the peak, excuse me, the trough back in late 2022. So, on a US dollar basis, it has pushed up now back above the 500 level and coming back into the region of the peaks from back in 2007, I'd say quite likely at some point this year. I don't believe that Europe is going to be immune from the potential for a recession. Having been in London earlier on this week, the one thing that I noticed was first, how much the price of everything has gone up. So that was certainly something that that really was noticeable. And then I also noticed the clear effects of the energy crisis, where there are really clear efforts underway to try and reduce energy usage. And the pound is starting to break up out of this most recent range. So, the increased discipline on the fiscal front is certainly being viewed as beneficial by investors against a background where there is no evidence of any real fiscal discipline in the USA. So, one thing that I think is especially interesting is that if we just simply look at the valuation on the FTSE 100, then it has a PE in almost single digits. And that contrasts really favorably with the most expensive shares in the USA. Now, value needs higher interest rates in order to be competitive. And if interest rates go back down, then the growth sector will continue to prosper. So I do think that we're going to have a lot of back and forth. We'll have a lot more volatility. And I think it's also particularly relevant that what we are really seeing in the technology sector is that it's the large cap companies are doing best. And the advanced decline line for the NYSE securities is rolling over, although it hasn't quite rolled over yet, but it's certainly susceptible to doing that. And then the underperformance of the Nasdaq's advanced decline line, where it is now trending down, that's a clear indication that we're seeing the average stock not doing well. And the Russell 2000 has been a clear picture of underperformance. Now, it was off the lows in here today, and we're towards the lower side of the range. And There's a lot of financials in the Russell 2000. So what happens with banks is going to have an impact here. But I guess my biggest fear right now is that everything that has been a reliable lead indicator for a recession is flashing red right now. And yet stocks are still going higher. So do we give the benefit of the doubt to the rebound, or is it better to hold cash in anticipation of a much deeper pullback later? Well, personally, I'm holding more cash. I'm willing to go short, and I'm holding bonds. I'm also holding gold miners because I think gold is going to be a bigger beneficiary. I've been slow to buy stocks because I don't want to have to be trading stocks in and out. But if one is backing the rebound on the assumption that there is going to be a soft landing and that corporate earnings aren't going to be impacted in the slightest, then this is certainly a time to be particularly diligent about stops and to be very diligent about knowing where to sell if one is buying in. Now, there are certainly pockets of continued performance, and we're definitely seeing that the consumer staples portion of the market is very strong. And companies like McDonald's are breaking on the upside. Companies like Pepsi are really very firm. And then when we think about the healthcare sector, there are certainly pockets of strong performance where we have really strong trends overall. And every one of these types of autonomy type companies have got unique characteristics that they are little oligarchies and they dominate their respective niches. So they're in a strong position to defend their market share, and they get their pricing power back in an inflationary environment. And that was actually the reason that we put together the autonomies in the first place, was to identify companies that would have pricing power in an inflationary environment. We thought that inflation would become more of a problem in 2012 and 2013 because of all the money printing. Well, we were wrong about that. But I think what we can think about is that we do have inflation now, and those companies are doing well as a result. Are they going to be completely immune from a recession in future? I think that's unlikely. But will they bounce back faster? I think that's very likely. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I wish all the